Performing his solo Charles Dickens show at the Walnut Street Theatre. Williams was born in 1905 in a Welsh mining town. Since going to London in the mid-1920s, he's had an active career as a stage and film actor, playwright, director, and author. Perhaps you've seen the film The Corner's Green, which starred Katharine Hepburn, and was based on the play that he wrote about his own childhood in Wales. We'll talk about his career, his travels, and his interpretation of Dickens when he joins us. Every Tuesday at 3:30, we feature Jazz Revisited, a survey of recorded jazz from 1917 to 1947. The subject today is the Jazz Record Book, selected recordings from the 1942 book by Charles Edward Smith, William Russell, and Frederick Ramsey. At about 3 o'clock today, Terry Rouse, the curator of the Studio Museum in Harlem, will be with us. We'll discuss how the museum interacts with the community. With me now is Louis L'Amour, who was recently described in Time magazine as maybe the most famous obscure writer in America. He's written 79 Western novels. 100 million of his books are now in print. He's believed to have sold more books in Canada and the U.S. last year than any other novelist. His novels are about the birth and the settlement of the American frontier. His novels include The Mountain Valley War, The Proving Trail, Lonely on the Mountain, and Hanging Woman Creek. His new book is called Comstock Lode, and it's set on a mountainside rich with silver, which attracts many different people to the area for many different reasons. His books that have been made into movies include Hondo, starring John Wayne, Heller in Pink Tights, The Burning Hills, Shalico, and Catlow. Louis L'Amour, welcome to Fresh Air.
It's nice to be here.
My interest in Westerns was developed by growing up with television and going to see a lot of Western movies. Since you grew up before television, I was wondering how you became interested in the Western.
I became interested largely because I heard it around home. My great-grandfather was killed and scalped by the Indians, and my grandfather fought Indians up in Dakota. And later, when I was a small boy, some of the Indians that he used to fight used to come around and visit him. And they would sit out on the lawn and drink coffee and talk over the old battles.
No kidding, so they got to be friends.
Oh, sure. Well, you see, contrary to what a lot of people think, the Indians and white men, particularly the white soldiers, were friendly when they were not fighting. And they were often very friendly. And my grandfather and these old Indians would sit around and talk over old battles the way we'd talk about a football game.
What are some of the stories that were handed down in your family that stayed in your mind the most?
Well, that one particularly about his death, about my great-grandfather's death, I should say. He was with the Sibley Command. The Indians under Little Crow arose and massacred about 800 or 900 people in Minnesota in 1862 and then fled out across the plains of Dakota, and they were pursued by the Sibley Command, and my great-grandfather was with them. And during the course of the... They hadn't seen the Indians for some time, and during the course of the march, he went with a man named George F. Brackett, who was a beef contractor with the Army, and they went out hunting. There was an Indian scout with them, and they saw from some distance away some people riding across the hills in uniforms. They could see the sun glinting on the buttons. And the Indian guide told them they were Indians, but Brackett didn't believe it. And my great-grandfather hadn't seen them. Brackett and the Indian had seen them. So my great-grandfather was skinning out a deer he had just killed. So... The Indian fled. The Indian guide rode away. He said, no, they were Indians and they should get out of there. But a few minutes later, they came riding over the hill, and they were Indians wearing army uniforms of the coats of the men they'd killed, you see. And there were about 40 of them. And they shot down my great-grandfather and killed him instantly. But Brackett, with great presence of mind, fell off his horse at the same time. And when he fell down, he crawled into the reeds around a lake. And while they were busy scalping my great-grandfather and dividing up the loot, his horse and his Colt automatic rifle, I mean, not automatic, but revolving rifle, and his other gear, why, Brackett got away and finally got back to Fort Lincoln and later became mayor of Minneapolis. And he wrote an account of this himself, of how it all happened.
So that's how you were able to find out the story.
Yes. And... I'm going up there to visit my great-grandfather's grave before long. I have pictures of it, but I've never seen it myself.
So when you started seeing movies, What was your reaction to them, the way movies and the way television serials also portray the West?
Well, sometimes they're right, sometimes they're wrong, sometimes they border on being right, sometimes we exaggerate a little bit. The great difficulty is that too many people in movies and television don't take the time to find out what the truth was, or approximate the truth at least. I can understand where leeway has to be taken sometimes for dramatic reasons, but that should be done as little as possible, and I'm able to write my stories without deviating from the truth at all.
Can you give us an example of a film that you thought was true to history the way you understand it and a film that you thought was distorted?
Well, Jeremiah Johnson, for example, was a film that was very true to history. It presented a very clear picture of a mountain man, and it took time to linger over some of the Indian-white relationships, you know, and also the his riding through the graveyard was a beautiful job. In most movies, that would have been passed over very quickly, and you'd lost all the flavor of it. And the John Wayne, John Ford pictures, Fort Apache and She Wore a Yellow Ribbon, they were very accurate. They presented the army very much as it was in those days. And there have been a number of such pictures, but there have been just too many that were bad. And I don't like to point the finger at anyone in particular, but I've had a number of pictures of my own stories made, and some of them were very bad, some of them good.
I guess that's disturbing to you when you don't like the way something's been interpreted.
Well, I don't like it, and particularly as it was so unnecessary in most cases. I wrote a story once about five people in a small mining camp, mining gold, and they were surrounded, there were Indians around. You didn't see the Indians but about once or twice in the story, and only two or three of them then, but they were there, largely a device to hold the people together. And the conflict was all between the characters of these people who were involved. And it was a relatively simple story, but an excellent character story. When they made it in the movies, they brought in a cattle drive. They brought in all kinds of things that had nothing to do with the story at all and cluttered it up. So you lost the whole effect of it, and the powerful characters disappeared. They just vanished.
What do you think's gotten the biggest bum rap from Westerns? Do you think Indians have gotten a bum rap?
Oh, everybody has, really. The Indians have, but not only the Indians, everybody has. See, the trouble with the Indian and white man largely was that it was a problem of two cultures coming together, very dissimilar, with no common ground of understanding. Even when both of them, with the best intentions, wanted to understand, there was just too much they couldn't understand because the viewpoints were so different. And when a white man bought land, he usually bought it with the idea of farming. When an Indian sold land, he thought he was selling the right to hunt on the land. He never thought of anybody fencing it and keeping him out, you know. And the viewpoint was just so different. The Indian had never conceived of ownership of land. The land was there, and it always had been there, and it always would be there as far as he was concerned. And it could be used by anybody in his tribe, at least. The Indians had certain more or less restricted areas of hunting where they kept others out. And what a lot of people don't seem to realize is that the Indians were constantly at war with each other and pushing each other off the hunting grounds and taking them over, you know. And there was a lot of conflict back and forth. The whole trouble is that people have never really tried to understand the situation, and they never have grasped the fact, which is so obvious, that Indians as well as white men are people. And some of them are bad, some of them are good, and some of them are weak, and some of them are strong. And both sides made mistakes all the way along, and it was too bad. There were other things about the Indian they didn't understand, too. One was that in only a few tribes, and I mean very few, did the chief have any real power. The chief only had the power that his prestige would give him. The Indians had a very democratic society. They had a council where any warrior could stand up and speak in council and could make his weight felt according to his ability to speak. So consequently, some of them became magnificent orators. They're Indian orators who could rank with Demosthenes or Winston Churchill or anybody. A great gift for colorful language and expressive language. But the white man sat down to deal with the chief, thinking he spoke for his tribe. And he only spoke what he believed and what he wished for his tribe. But he had no way of compelling obedience. So many times the old Indians made peace and the young Indians made war.
Another example of misunderstanding the way a culture
works.
Mm-hmm. Can you read us a passage from your newest book, which is called Comstock Lode?
Well, this is a story about the mineral discovery at Virginia City, Nevada. But my character is a Cornishman, what they used to call a Cousin Jack.
Hey, well, why did they call him a Cousin Jack?
Well, it was a term actually given by American miners who didn't approve of them. The Cornishmen were the only ones who knew how to mine ore. You see, up until that time, the mining in the West had all been placer mining, washing the gold out of the sand, you know. When they found a big deposit of ore, it had to be mined, and you had to know how to do this. Well, the Cornishmen in Cornwall, England, had mined tin and had mined copper, and they knew how. So they came into the West, and they began doing this. But as soon as a Cornishman got a job in a mine, he would go to the superintendent or the owner, and he would say, "Look, I've got a Cousin Jack." And you just bring him, and pretty soon the mine would be filled with Cornishmen. So they got to calling him Cousin Jacks. Well, this story, this is the very beginning of the story, the opening paragraphs. It began with a dream. A dream that ended in horror. It began in a thatched cottage with wind around it and rain beating on the shutters, with a flagstone floor and the smell of fish frying, and his mother putting blue plates on the table, and his father sitting by the fire. It began in Cornwall, England, in 1849. It began with listening to the storm blowing in from the sea and the fire hissing from occasional drops that fell down the chimney. It began with Val Trevelyan's father saying, "Mary, we are going to America."
Is there a story like that in your family, the story of the coming to America?
No, but my family did come that way, and many others did. What I tell here is typical of many, many American families coming not only from England or Ireland or Scotland, but from many other places as well. You see, there's a very important thing about that that's too little understood in America, and that is that something happened here that never happened anywhere else in the world to the same extent. Men came here of their own volition. So many places, great migrations were ordered by a chief or a king or an emperor or an army was doing it, or they came because of a drought. Here they came because I decided I wanted to come, and you decided you wanted to come. And some came and some stayed. I think those who came had some special thing in their genes that made them willing to venture out into the unknown. And I think that's why we put a man on the moon. I think that's why we've opened up that new frontier.
Well, when America was being settled, there was a frontier. There always was a new territory to settle and to civilize, to build homes in. And I know there's a whole school of history who feels like the psychology of our country and the motivation of our country is related to having that frontier. Do you feel that way, too?
Oh, very definitely, but different than many. I take the long view of things. You see, one great difficulty with our civilization today is that we live now. We live in the now, in the immediate, all the time. Part of this is due to the media, and I'm not saying this in a derogatory term, but radio, television, and newspapers give us the now every single second of the time. Something has hardly happened before it's flashed on the news. The sound of a shot is hardly gone before we see a picture of the body lying on the pavement. So all of us are thinking in terms of now, and we don't back off and take the long view to see what's happening over the years. Now, we have reached the end of our frontier, we say. All we have done is reached a landing on a long stairway. We've stopped, we're catching our breath, and now we go on ahead to the new and greatest frontier of all out there in space. A frontier that will never end and never can end because it goes on forever and ever. It's a different kind of frontier. It'll be handled a different way. But the men who do it will be a good deal the same kind of men that opened up the West and women.
How have you been following what's happening in space exploration? Do you read a lot about that?
Yeah, I read a great deal about it, and NASA sends me all their publications, so I'm aware of what's going on. I also subscribe to about 20 scientific magazines of one kind or another. I'm very interested because this is the frontier. This is the future. And I was making a speech not long ago about the West, and I said, I ended my speech with the phrase that the cowboy didn't ride off into the sunset. He rode into the future. And when I say the cowboy, I mean the Western man. And we all at heart are that man, whether we're in the West or the East or wherever. This is our heritage. The frontier is our heritage. And the frontier is our future.
You know, one difference, well, I see a lot of differences, I guess, between the settling of the West and the settling of space, but one of the ones that strikes me right away is that the people who are going into space are always representatives of someone, of a country, or of I guess mostly of a country at this point, but they represent larger interests. It's not like when people came west, it's like the story you told of a family saying, well, our son isn't going to be a minor here anymore. We're going to give him a chance that we never had. Yes. We're moving to America. But it's different so far. When people go into space, they're selected by given medical tests.
Yes, but now wait just a minute. This is the very thing. We're living in the now, you see. And when the first people came to America, they came the same way, on carefully selected ships, some sent by Sir Walter Raleigh, some sent by other people, but they came over here just in the Mayflower with a bunch of carefully selected people. They came the same way. Then, once they began making landings, getting a toehold, then the whole thing opened up and other people came. And you see, so we have to take the long view. We have to realize that at first it has to be this way. But after it gets opened up, and after the first preliminary steps are taken, now the first people who came over here had to learn how to live in this new land. They didn't know how to build log cabins at first. That they had to learn later. They first built the same mud and wattle houses they'd had in England. But gradually they began to learn how to live in this land, and then other people could come over and adapt. But there had to be those first pioneers. If you take a look at the astronauts, they're the same kind of men who went west. They're the same kind of men you might find riding on ranches or wherever, maybe with less education the ranchers had than these fellows, but nevertheless the same type of men personally.
Mm-hmm. I was wondering how you'd feel about the technology that's involved with space exploration, since I've always thought that part of the myth of the settlement of the West was men and women in direct confrontation with nature, with animals and the wilderness, and having to, quote, tame all of that. But a very direct relationship, which is very different than the reliance that one needs on technology in order to get to space. And
not really so different, just a different level. But the same problems faced in a slightly different way. Just as everything has changed now, everything has become more mechanical, people are more accustomed to machines now than they used to be. And they're more accustomed to working this way. And it would be very difficult for them to go back to a primitive method because they will expect all the modern contemporary methods to be used. Really, the differences are very slight and only in tune with the times.
Mm-hmm. What are the mistakes that you think were maybe made during the settlement of America that you think shouldn't be made again if we are actually heading into a new frontier, outer space?
They should be very careful. They should be very careful not to damage the system that is there, the climatic system, the land system, and whatnot. One thing that a lot of people seem to have forgotten is that this land we occupy is only ours for the time being. We only hold it in trust for future generations, and we should try to leave it a little bit better than we got it, or at least as good. I'm afraid we're not doing that, and we should look with care on all use of land, and it should be carefully judged before any changes are made. I think, for one, that we're paving too much of it, because the world, the earth, is a living organism. It has to breathe, and it has to have its effect on the climate and on the clouds and everything, and I think we're paving too much of it now, and the climate is, the effect is going to be very adverse.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to get back to some of the stories that you tell in your books. Do you like your books to leave your readers with a message or a moral?
No, I have no message in any of my books. I am telling the story of the opening up of the continent, and I have no symbolism in my books. People look for it there; they're mistaken. Symbolism is something that was largely discovered by critics and English teachers. Most writers didn't have it there. Unhappily, some are placing it there, and it's kind of forced. If there is any symbolism, it should creep into the story naturally and easily. Nobody should start out to sell a bill of goods with a book. He shouldn't try to write a book for a certain purpose. If he feels anything enough, it will come out in the book, and he can't conceal it. But then it will come naturally, it'll come in a normal way, and it'll get over much better, be much more effective. If he just writes the book the way he sees it, he can't conceal his feelings, they're bound to come out.
Can you tell us about some of the families that you've written about, the makeup of the families?
Yes, I have. I've written the core of my work, not all of my work certainly, but the core of my work is about three families who migrated from Europe to America. The Sacketts, who come from England and Wales, the Chantrys, who come from Ireland, and the Talons, who came from France to Canada, after many adventures, however. Through the eyes of these three families, I'm trying to show what the opening of America was like. You know, each people has its traditional storytellers. They used to sit in the marketplaces of the Middle East and tell stories. Chaucer told his stories. Homer told the story of the Greeks. Each people has theirs. I, in telling my stories, am carrying on the tradition of my people. These are our stories. These are the American stories. These are the stories of the country we live in and of how it came to be what it is, for better or worse. And this is the story that I'm telling. I want to be able to have you see all that I have been fortunate enough to learn. And I translate it to you and to the audience in the nature of a story, because that's the best way to always tell such things. And it's very important to me that I do this, because I've been extremely fortunate. Not only did I first start hearing stories from my grandparents, and I heard about my great-grandparents, but during my travels around as a boy, I worked with a lot of the old gunfighters and outlaws. I knew them personally. And I am probably the last writer of the West who actually had communion and talked with these people who lived it.
Oh, I'd love to hear about some of the gunfighters who...
Well, I knew a number of them. I've known five men and two women who knew Billy the Kid personally and well. I was taught to use a six-shooter by Bill Tillman, who was a frontier marshal. As a matter of fact, very few gunfighters intended to be such. When you give golf clubs to 100 men, one of them is going to turn out to be very good, better than all the rest. Several will be quite good, and the rest will be just duffers, no matter what they do. It was the same with guns. And by the time they'd won two or three fights, they had a reputation, whether they wanted it or not. So gunfighters were ranchers, they were lawyers, they were doctors, they were all kinds of people. And some of them were outlaws. Oddly enough, very few were outlaws. Most of them were other kinds of people who became marshals and because of their known skills, you see. But what people fail to grasp is that all over the world, from the beginning of time, men had settled their arguments by personal combat. At first, this was considered the judgment of the gods. Let two men fight it out, and the gods would judge who should win. And later, it was just the way gentlemen settled disputes. At first, it was with battle axes and lances, and then it became rapiers, and finally, it became guns. And it wasn't only in the West that shooting was taking place. Only in the East and in Europe, it was mostly, duels were formal. We exchanged cards and we had seconds. We met in a prescribed place to shoot. Alexander Pushkin, the Russian poet, for example, was killed in a duel right about this time. And shortly before this time, Alexander Hamilton was killed in a duel. Andrew Jackson was involved in 102 duels in one way or another, although he only killed one man in a duel. And Senator Thomas Hart Benton killed several men in duels. This was a customary way. In the West, I didn't know whether you were a gentleman or not, so we didn't exchange cards. We just shot at the spur of the moment. And the fast draw became important, although less important than making the first shot count. I talked to a number of those old-timers, and they were men who had one outstanding characteristic. I'm not speaking only of the gunfighter then. I'm speaking of the Western man as such. He had dignity. They had the dignity even though they were poor men. They didn't think poor or feel poor because they had pride of being, pride in themselves, and self-respect. And this was the first thing you noticed about them. And I noticed it about these men that I knew. I talked to George Coe, who lost a finger in one of the gun battles that Billy the Kid was in. And I talked to Tom Pickett, who was wounded in a couple of those gun battles. And they told me about the old days and about Billy, for example. All kinds of wrong stories are developed about him. He was no moron. He was nothing of the kind. He was a very attractive young man, actually, but a young man that you didn't push. He became more highly skilled than most of the others around him. and more steady of nerve. And oddly enough, of the 200 men involved in the Lincoln County War, or approximately 200, he was the only one indicted for it. And he was being made the goat for the whole thing, which was unfair.
Do you think the people who you spoke to who used to be gunfighters felt empty because they couldn't walk around with guns anymore?
Oh, no. Not at all. None of them particularly wanted to. Only at the time they were living, it was necessary. It was necessary that they have them. They were very useful to them, not only to fight men, but for many other things. In fact, men was the last use they expected to put them to. But such a weapon was absolutely essential. No, I don't think so at all. They didn't feel anything about it. Most of them were only too willing to hang up their guns. Most of the gunfighters were young men, between 17 and 21. And if they lived beyond 30, they usually lived very long lives. Because after they began to be beyond 25, they began to get good sense and realize there was no point in it, that getting killed or killing somebody else made no sense.
One of the constant themes in Western movies is the coming of law into a town, a town that was maybe run by hoodlums and outlaws, and trying to get a sheriff in there who could control the ruffians of mm-hmm. of the area and bring order to a world of chaos. Were there real stories like that?
Yes, there were. There were stories like that. Oddly enough, the ruffians weren't the ones they were trying to control usually, though they needed control. But it was just the high-spirited young cowboys who might get a drink or two and shoot their guns at random, you know. Most of them not trying to make any trouble at all. They were just blowing off steam. But they needed somebody who could hold them in restraint and say, look, fellas, let's take it a little bit easy now. Have a good time, but let's not get anybody hurt. And fellows like Wild Bill Hickok and Bill Tillman and these men did that sort of thing. And on the whole, very successfully.
Tell us about some of the women who are characters in your novels. And thinking back to a lot of movies now, and there's different typical roles you'll find women in. One is, of course, the saloon girl. Another is the schoolmarm who comes in to help educate and civilize a territory. Then, of course, there's also women on ranches and farms who were mothers, or and then well, then there's the whole. I guess there's so many different.
There were
typical
many
parts here. I'm thinking also of like Annie Oakley and.
Yeah, well, Annie Oakley was very typical of the time. Really, she was a girl who had learned to become an extraordinary shot because she'd been hunting meat for the table, and finally she got so good at it she was hunting meat to sell to the market, and because she was an expert shot, but this was why many of the Western people could shoot so well. Was because if they didn't hunt the meat, they wouldn't have any meat. But there were all kinds of women in the West with one definite characteristic. They were strong. It's a fact not generally realized now, but women's suffrage began in the West. The whole ERA people should go back and study the West a little bit, because the first woman ever elected to office in the United States was in South Pass City, Wyoming, in 1870, and she was elected Justice of the Peace. The first woman congresswoman was Janet Rankin from Montana. The first woman governor was Nellie Taylor Ross from Wyoming. Western men always respected their women. And I say respected them, I don't mean respect them only in a sexual sense, but respected them as persons and as people. And I have said it a couple times in books, and somebody wrote me a letter long ago and said I was saying it too often. So I probably won't say it again. But the point that I'm making is a true one, and that is the Western man wanted a woman to walk beside him, not behind him.
What do you think of the Equal Rights Amendment?
I think it's fine, but I think most of it's already been covered in other amendments.
You do?
Yes.
Like which?
Well, a whole lot. I couldn't go into a whole discussion of it now, but a whole lot of it has. I definitely believe in equal pay for equal work, because there's no comparison about that. It definitely should be there, but much of it has been covered.
Mm. What do you think of gun control? I wonder too. Since you're writing about a time when everybody had guns, and as you say, a lot of them willingly hung it up when the need for
I'm against gun control. I'm against it for several reasons. In the first place, because at the present state of the world, we need them for protection. The police can only come after the fact, after a crime has been committed. and very rarely will they come before. Occasionally, if they can, they will get there and they will try to do some good, but in many cases they can't. In many cases, the crime occurs in your own house, in your own bedroom, when suddenly you look up and somebody is standing over you, and it's you or them, you know, and usually it's you. Because in the first place, gun control won't stop anybody from doing anything. It won't stop any guns from being in existence. Already the country is flooded with them. And there are millions of people in the country who can make guns. They aren't that hard to make. You may remember only a few years ago, the street boys were making zip guns, with whom they were killing people. And a zip gun to be made in a matter of minutes.
Can you envision a society in which everybody had a gun?
Yes.
What do you think that would be like?
It was like the Western society, everybody did. There weren't many people killed in proportion.
Do you think that urban life and apartment buildings and people living and working in very crowded areas changes the nature of that?
To some extent. Not entirely. I don't believe anybody should carry guns. I don't believe in that. Except maybe on long trips in dangerous country or something. I believe guns should be used very sparingly. I believe there should be education about guns. For example, I've taught my children about them. They know that every gun is loaded. There is no such thing as an empty gun to my children. And they have grown up with that knowledge and with guns in the house all the time and thought nothing about it.
Have you ever had to use your guns?
No. Not in the United States. And I hope I never do have to. I would if I had to, but I don't want to, and I don't think anybody who has a gun does want to. Oddly enough, all of the assassinations of presidents in this country were performed by men who had no knowledge of guns, with the exception of Oswald, who had learned his in the Marine Corps, but up until that time had no experience of them at all. The man who has a gun, knows about guns, respects it, and knows it's a dangerous thing to have. There is another thing, too, that we don't think about so much, because we live in a comparative security. The reason that was put in our Constitution, that the right to own and bear arms shall not be abridged, it was put there because we had just won a revolution that we couldn't have won had we not been armed. We don't know when this country might be invaded, and the army will never get there in time.
Because you think if we all had the right to own handguns, we'd win a war easier?
Well, we'd be able to defend ourselves to an extent. During World War II, and this is a chapter that's very little known, during World War II, the Japanese were sending some fire balloons over northern part of the United States and Canada to set forest fires. Some of those balloons landed up in Oregon. The story got out, as stories are always exaggerated, the story got out that the Japanese had made a paratroop landing back up there in the hills. There wasn't any army within miles. But within a matter of minutes, the road was black with farmers and businessmen armed going up there to repel that supposed invasion. And they could do it. Now, it's always said, well, we never will be. That is nonsense. We will be one of these days. And I hope we're ready to do something about it. Mm-hmm. I do think that people should be taught how to use weapons and taught to respect them. I think that anybody who uses a gun in a crime should be punished to the limit of the law. And I mean the very limit. I mean there should be no plea bargaining. There should be no ifs, ands, or buts. In early day mining law, you know, the mining camps made their own law. There was no law there, so they got together 8 or 10, 12 men, and they decided what laws they were to have. And they said, if you do such and such, such and such happens. And there was no quibbling about it. There were no lawyers involved, no plea bargaining. And I think it should be that way now. If a man kills somebody with a gun, he should be executed or sent to penitentiary for life.
No trial?
Oh, trial, certainly. But I mean to prove that he's guilty or innocent. But if he is proven guilty, no question about how many years he's to get or anything. The full limit. It would stop in a hurry.
My guest is Louis L'Amour, who writes Western novels, and he's considered to be one of the best-selling American authors, and his new book is called Comstock Load, and he's got about 79 books to his credit, I think. Now, I understand your books are very popular amongst people in government, who are some of the people in government now who read your books?
Oh, I couldn't begin to name them all. A good many of our State Department, most of the FBI, several advisors to the president, and a number of senators and congressmen read my books. And, well, the thing is, my books talk about America. They tell the American story, you see. And about half my readers are women, interestingly enough. And, but it's...
So what do you think it is about your books that makes them so popular amongst people who are in government or who are advisors to the president? I don't know how many authors could make that claim that so many people in governmental positions read them.
I don't know. I think it's the fact that I hopefully tell a good story, and I tell a story about developing America. I think it's a good way to see capsulized history, you know, and to see how some problems were handled in the old days. Mm-hmm. Because my stories are history.
I remember when Oriana Fallaci interviewed Henry Kissinger, mm-hmm. He was describing what it's like for him when he goes to another country to negotiate there. And she said, oh, I see, so you see yourself as a hero in the Old West who rides in alone on his horse to do battle. And he said, yes, that's the way I see it. And they went on to discuss it. That ended up for him, I think, being one of the most embarrassing interviews that he ever gave, because mm-hmm. that became very highly quoted. I think he was really embarrassed. Did you ever read that interview?
Yes, I heard about it a good deal. I think just it was misinterpreted. I'm not a tremendous admirer of Henry Kissinger. I think his work often did very good work. But I think in that case he was simply misquoted and misunderstood. And in many cases that was exactly what he was doing. He was going into a difficult situation and trying to bring some solution to it. And we need people who are willing to do that. Right now, the country is in a serious situation, and we need a lot of people who are willing to be daring.
Our president now is someone who actually appeared in Western movies. How does that make you feel?
Well, that doesn't affect him one way or the other, I think. He didn't appear in that many Westerns, and I don't think it makes that much difference one way or the other. What will depend on with him is his judgment of people, his judgment of the situation, and his ability to sell the American people on what needs to be done.
Mm-hmm. Do you have faith in him?
I'm waiting to see. I do have faith in him, yes. I like the things he has said. Now we'll have to see whether he can do them or not. And that it doesn't depend only on him, unhappily. It depends on the Congress, and to a great extent on the people. And there are a great many groups who are thinking only of their own benefit and not of the benefit of the country as a whole. It's a time now when we have to take drastic measures. We have to, all of us have to tighten our belts. And that means all of the special interest groups, too. They have to put their own interests aside for the time being and think only of the benefit of the country.
Many people are saying that people are being asked to tighten their belts, but large corporations are receiving the benefits under the new administration.
I don't know whether that's true or not. We'll have to wait and see about that.
We've been talking about your view of America and settling the frontier and how what the frontier symbolizes in the American past and what kind of things we can maybe learn from it for the future. But there's another part of America, the cities, the East, the areas that have been populated by people from Italy and Hungary and refugees in the 19th and early 20th centuries. Does that part of life, does the Lower East Side of New York, for instance, does the settling of Philadelphia relate to the lessons that one would learn looking at the mining towns in the West, or looking at the confrontations between American settlers and the Indians who were there? Or are those two completely different Americas? Looking at them as metaphors.
They're two different Americas, but they speak to each other. They're two different Americas. In the one great difficulty was that too many people came in here from Europe, from the areas of Europe that had too little opportunity for education, and they were bundled together in crowds of themselves, in what you might call the ghettos or the corners of large cities, without having due opportunity to absorb the American way of life, which the English and Irish and whatnot, well, the English especially, had a better chance of doing because it came in more sparse groups and had more time. The Italians, for example, and the Polish people and the Russians and many others, those who stayed in the cities, were crowded together, and they had too little opportunity to learn the difference of the country they were in. And they hadn't begun to appreciate that this was a different country and they could live a different way. Here and there, people did. And here and there, as they began to move west, they began to take advantage of the opportunities. They began to see what it offered. But the Irish, I think, were the first to do that. They were bundled up in the cities, but some of them began to join the cavalry and get out west. And then they began to get into politics, and finally one of them becomes John Kennedy. But the point is that they were perhaps quicker than some of the others to take advantage of the opportunities and to realize what could be done here by the individual.
Do you think too many people from Europe and the Eastern European countries moved here?
No, I don't think too many at all. I think we have benefited to a great degree from all these people because each one brought something from his own country that could be given to us, and we have profited from them all. You know, France, for example, is so desperately anxious to keep its language pure. I personally don't think it's a good idea. I think a language is a vital thing. It should be growing and expanding all the time. Well, ours has grown and expanded not only with the new scientific terms, but with words from all the languages of the people that have come here. You'll find people in daily conversation use words from Spanish, from Italian, from Hebrew, from all kinds of Yiddish, from all kinds of things. I think it's good. And I think our absorbing of customs from other countries is good. It makes our life richer and more beautiful.
Do you think there is an American way of life?
Oh, yes, I definitely do.
How would you describe it?
A greater sense of freedom, more open air sort of life. It's just simply a fresher, more open viewpoint. You know, I have had this said to me by many men, not one or two. As it happens in California and in Orange and Los Angeles counties, there are about 70,000 active scientists working in that area. And I've talked to quite a few of them, and many of them came from Europe. And they all speak about the great freedom of opportunity that is over here. In so many of the European countries, it's so compartmentalized, you know. It's such a, if I have an idea, I have to take it to the man who's in charge of my department and submit it to him. Well, maybe he doesn't like me. Maybe he's jealous of the idea. Maybe he figures, what's this upstart doing? This is something I should have thought about. So he does nothing about it. And many times ideas are stymied right on the lowest level, and very rarely do they get to the people who could appreciate them. Over here, it's very easy to get that idea across. Sometimes it happens here too, you understand, but not often. And if he doesn't get his idea across here, he can move to another company and do it, you know. Opportunity for advancement and for development is greater here.
Do you think your image of what the American way of life is would be changed if you were, say, poor and living in a city, say, Philadelphia or New York?
It very possibly would, but I was poor. For the first few years of my life, I slept in boxcars. I slept in old lumber piles. I got work where I could find it, which wasn't very often. I went hungry many times, several days, 4 days without eating anything after going hungry before that. And I've been through that. I know pretty much what it's like. I've gone for months on end, and you could find a day's work here, an hour's work there, and it was impossible to get any kind of a steady job. And we had to get along as best you could. And I've gone aboard ships in the harbor when you could do that sort of thing to get free meals because maybe the cook on the ship had been aboard ashore himself and broke. And if you had seaman's papers, they would sometimes feed you.
Well, you're a millionaire now. Is it a dream come true?
I don't think of that at all. The dream came true is in these books. This is what I wanted. I wanted to write books. I wanted to tell stories. And you see, I don't see myself as an author or a novelist. Being a millionaire doesn't enter my consciousness at all. I don't even think of it. I think mainly of what I have to sell. I'm a storyteller, and I want to tell stories the best way I know how, the stories of my country and how it grew and became what it is.
You were telling me before that you're recreating a town circa 1865.
Yes.
Can you just tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, I can. Incidentally, I want to say two things. First place, the town is not ready yet for anybody to come to visit. We have much work to do. The second thing is that nobody will live there because as soon as somebody wants to live there, they want a television aerial, and they want a car parked in front of the house. And I want a town that is absolutely inviolate, that is completely and entirely a Western town of that period, 1865 to 85, actually. I used to go around over the West, and I'd see a beautiful old-time building that I wanted to take a picture of. But sitting right in front of it was a car, which spoiled the effect of the picture. So I decided there should be some place where people could go, where they could see them as they were, in all their pristine glory or whatever. And so I got the idea of building the town. At first, I was going out and trying to buy an old ghost town and rebuild it myself, because I'm a pretty good country carpenter, you know, and fairly handy. But then my ideas expanded to a point where I could no longer do the work, and also I couldn't find the right place I wanted. And actually what I'm doing now is not rebuilding a ghost town, but we're going to build the town right from scratch to show you what one was like. The only difference will be that my town will be a little bit more complete than any Western town might have been. Maybe only one town out of five had a cooper making barrels, for example. I will have one. Are you familiar with Old Sturbridge, Massachusetts?
I haven't been there.
Well, you should go. It's worth a visit, believe me. It should be part of everybody's education. But this is what I hope to do for the West, what they did for colonial days.
You had a bit of a holdup for a while. I mean, not a robbery holdup, not a stick-em-up holdup, a delay caused by...
Yes, we had a power company who wanted to build right across the land and would have spoiled the whole effect, of course, and we couldn't. And we had a long fight over that, which we finally won. Also, there have been other difficulties with just red tape. Everybody wants to help us, but still there's just a lot that has to be gone through.
It's almost funny thinking of this power line crossing, the reconstruction of a Western town, because in the Westerns it's always the railroad moving to town and mm-hmm. destroying the cattle herds, and now it's the power company destroying the recreation of the Western town.
Yeah.
Well, when do you think it'll be completed?
I don't know for sure, but we're going to get quite a bit of work done this year.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
We have to slow up a little bit because I'm going to use it in a movie where we need a small town.
What's your favorite movie?
I don't have a favorite. I don't have a favorite novel either, or writer. I like various things from various writers, you know, and various movies.
Mm-hmm.
I like Jeremiah Johnson very much because of the fact that it took time to linger over a few things. And I think that any Western these days that's done right has to catch the atmosphere of the West. In the past, they've been too hurried. They've been making action pictures, you know, and they thought of the West strictly as an action picture. It's not. It is an action picture, but it can be a mood picture also. And I think you lose much if you lose the atmosphere.
Well, Louis L'Amour, I want to thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon about your work. Louis L'Amour is a writer, one of the best-selling writers in this country. He writes Western novels. Some of his novels have been made into movies. I guess the most famous is Hondo. And his new novel is called Comstock Lode. He's got 79 novels. That he's written. It's 9 minutes to 3 o'clock, and this is Fresh Air on WUHY FM in Philadelphia. In a few minutes on Fresh Air, we'll be talking about a very different part of the American experience. We'll be speaking with Terry Rouse, the curator of the Studio Museum in Harlem, New York. So that's coming up in just a few minutes. First, we have some records. This is Paul Whiteman from the 1920s, and the song is called Saddle Your Blues to a Wild Mustang.